Good evening, you all. I'm K2RIW. Stand by a minute.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the...
That was a little bit too noisy. Purpose of the TechNet, as you guys know, is people who want to know more about radio, wireless equipment, antennas, transmission lines. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and this is the 35th year, plus 1 month, of running the TechNet. So one of the longest running TechNets under one leadership that I think exists. Person signs into the TechNet because he's got a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Roy tonight, AC2GS, with his section, which possibly is going to be called either the Physic Talk section or the Physics Talk section. He has received an email by way of the chat room, which I think is what John used to do, KC2WGB, the previous person who ran the mailbag. I think some of his inputs were also by the chat room, so he's got some interesting puzzles and physics things to discuss tonight. After we go through the usual discussion of people who do have questions or a comment concerning ham radio, let me drop. So if you've gotten one of the homework assignments in past weeks to make some measurements on your equipment to find out what's going on, and you've got anything to report to us, please do so right now. So people with questions or comments or homework assignments, whatever, please give me a call. Letters right now. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
And to Rio, Dick, with questions.
KC2, Mike Delta Papa, Steve, and yes.
Right to RIY Joe. Yes.
Okay, we've got Rich, Steve, and Joe. I mean, yeah. Can't even read my own writing. Alrighty. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
And WS to Ann Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, Dick.
Good evening, Roy. Everybody else?
And most likely, Paul will have Space Report number 275 of the series that began years and years ago. 52 space reports per year, 275 of them all together. We can easily figure out how many years that is. Rich, go ahead, N2EO, K2RIW, listening.
Okay, Dick. You know, I fell into something that I might be interested in. Contacting the International Space Station. I did some, I looked at a whole bunch of YouTubes, and I did see on the ground there were people contacting. Most of it was schools, but not all of it. I'd like to know how much free time do they provide for individuals, not schools like me. The other thing is, I don't have... Just an assembly. This radio, it steps in 5 kilohertz. I don't think it will set lower. I think I'm going to have problems with the Doppler shift. So those are my 3 questions.
Okay, when it comes to contacting the International Space Station, ham radio operators, one of the guys who I know is very well informed on that because he's been involved in a number of those operations is Lou into RQ and also Bob, W2OSR. So I'd strongly recommend you talk to Lou or Bob on that particular subject. Let's see, if, before we go to the next subject, anybody on frequency who can answer Rich's question as to how often is there an empty space where you can talk to the astronauts if you're not part of a high school operation? Give me a call, let us if you get info on that. T2RIW.
WS21.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I think Rich knows that we got involved here in Mount Kokomo at the school, St. Joseph's Elementary School, because he helped us with the practicing with the kids. And yeah, it's true. It's a big deal. It's probably roughly a year before you could get a school to actually make a schedule for that. The best hope for an individual would be to listen to when they're going overhead over Long Island, in our case, and listen to the frequencies that they're transmitting on, receiving. And that would be the 2 meters you'd listen to. 145.800. But you have to set up your radio to transmit on 144.490. So it's not really an even split. You know, not a standard split. So that's what they do. Then you have to know when they're going to be going overhead. Let me drop it.
And when they've got free time to be on the ham radio equipment.
That's the part you don't know. So the best thing to do is you get the app. And there's a couple ways of doing it. I have the ISS detector, and that lets you know every time they're going to be going overhead visually. And then radio-wise, you can extend that by a couple of minutes because the radio horizon goes a little further than that. So it's roughly a visual pass in 6 minutes, but you can get a 12-minute pass out of it. And just hope that somebody's on listening at that time. It's a roll of the dice. But they do have packet. I don't have the frequency or pan on that. Some people have made use of the packet system. There's 2 radios on board, the Russian side and the NASA side. And they use them intermittently. Russians are always in the Zarya module, and we've been in the Columbia module. And now there's a move to have another location, actually, in the Discovery module. That might be coming up in probably another 6 months or so. But nevertheless, the frequency is the same. It's 145.800 and then transmitting on 144.490. Back to you, Dick.
That's very good information, Paul. One last question. Could you use Heavens Above to find out when they're going to be visually? But that's still not going to give you enough information as to when they're active. I think you're saying there is a website you can download telling you when they're going to be overhead, and maybe it gives you a hint as to whether or not it's during one of their free periods as opposed to a sleep period or a work period. Go ahead.
Repeater, timeout.
Well, NASA and ESA, they're usually on, they're mostly on Houston time, believe it or not. They go by that, so we're about an hour difference than that. And their awake period, you could figure their awake period and free time would probably be around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. So if you could match that up with, say, your
your passes. I use the ISS detector, which is good. It'll give you warnings. It'll tell me the next 10 days that it's coming up. For instance, I know the next, next 8 days were all AM times, all early in the morning. But with heavens above, you're right, you can get like 12 o'clock in the afternoon passes, you know. You know, things like that. So heavens above is good, and an ISS detector is good. And if you pay, I think, an extra $3 or something, you can get the radio passes as well. Back to you, sir.
Have you ever heard a non-high school or non-school person making a QSO with the ISS pulse?
I used to listen quite a bit when before the space station actually went up in 1992. I heard the STS-45. It was Atlantis going over, so I heard them go over, and they were making contact with somebody directly down here. In those days, if you wrote down the call sign that they were talking to and sent that into NASA, you would get a QSL card back, and which I did. I got a NASA QSL card back, but I contact them. It's one way. It's not a regular QSL. You know, it's not two way. It doesn't count as that, but it's one way. That's good enough. So it's an SWL. Back to you there.
Okay, that was way back in the 1990s you described. In the last few years, have you ever heard of a person not associated with a high school making a QSO, either by packet or by voice, with a ISS astronaut?
No, I haven't. I haven't been listening on a regular basis. So not since the back then. But, you know, if you're patient enough, I guess you can do it. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead with that person.
Yeah, if you do a search on YouTube, there's a number of folks that have recorded and put their QSOs on YouTube. And there was an article, I think, in QST of another guy describing the contact.
I have the impression, Eric, that it's a somewhat rare event, that they don't have that much free time. Their free time isn't always spent on the ham radio. Their free time on ham radio is booked for the schools. And so for them to go looking for random QSOs of individuals, I think is a little bit rare, but I might be wrong. Over to you for a comment on that, Eric.
Yeah, from what I've read, that every time they do get a chance and they do go to the radio, with particular astronauts, which are very much into the ham radio, they use whatever spare moment they have, spend a little time on the radio, and I think it was described in what the astronaut hears when he puts out a call for a couple of seconds and then he gets a barrage. So obviously there's people out there that are constantly listening to the frequency.
Okay, so when Rich does a little bit more checking with Lou and Bob, W2OSR and N2RQ, I think he's going to get a little bit more information. Paul has direct experience by way of St. Joseph Elementary School, and I know that Lou and Bob have done a number of those hookups with schools, and they probably have a lot of direct info. Restate your antenna question that you had also, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW.
By the way, the Limark has supported a couple of school contacts, but they're usually through the telephone line.
When Limark was supporting, wasn't it usually through Lou and Bob, though? Go ahead.
Yeah, Lou, Bob, and Richie. I lend them a phone pad that they hook into the public address system so that they put a microphone up on the stage so that the student can speak to the astronaut, and the output goes into the PA so that everybody listening can hear what's going on.
Sounds like a good broadcast audio man on that there. Well done. Yeah, I should have realized that our president, Rich, also is heavily involved with the ISS operations. Okay, restate your antenna question, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. First of all, I did talk to Luke. He's only familiar with what goes on in schools. You know, he's always helping the kids out, which is a great thing. He's not familiar with a one-on-one contact with the ISS. My last and final question is, if I buy one of these M-squared antennas, they have two loops at 90 degrees standing vertically, and they have four radios at the bottom. Couldn't I just make it regular turnstile? What is the necessity for the loops? And I may have a problem following the ISS. This is not a multi-mode radio. It's just an FM radio. So I don't think I can get it a step in less than 5 kilohertz.
But even with 5 kilohertz steps, I think it would be possible to get it on the transmit frequency of 144.490. I don't think that's a forbidden frequency. Do you, Rich? Oh, if it's a purely FM rig, yeah, that your FM rig may not go there. Hoping for an answer on that one, Rich.
144.490. I believe it will. But what about Doppler shift as it goes overhead?
Yeah, the Doppler shift is proportional to frequency. When you're on 2 meters, the amount of frequency shift is only a couple of kilohertz, I think. We can check on that. And a FM receiver is very forgiving. I believe that people are doing ISS contacts on 2 meters. Do not worry about Doppler. Let's see if Paul will confirm that. WS2N, I bet you guys didn't bother offsetting. It just depended on the bandwidth of the FM receiver to handle that. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
We went through the telebridge. We used that similar setup, I guess, what Eric was talking about. We had something, they call it DAT1. It's a little gadget that you hook up to your telephone and the whole audience could hear it, but we were when we were talking from the school, the kids were, the voice was going out to Santa Rosa Junior College in California, and I don't know, I still don't know what kind of shape they were in after all those fires. That was right in the middle of the fires they had in California. Still haven't gotten an update on them. But I'm sure they were shut down for a while. But they do a lot of volunteering for school contacts, and they transmit on that particular frequency. They didn't talk about Doppler shift at all. They said they were going to go up on 144. That's what I know. Back to you, Dick.
AC2GS?
Right ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. As I always say, Google is your friend. Rich, if you just Google ISS amateur radio, you come up with a bunch of pages. I'm looking at something called ARISS.org. It has a whole bunch of stuff and places to click and information. So let Google be your friend, Richard. By the way, I don't think that individuals can get slow scan. I think slow scan, it is a public relations thing, but you might be able to have a voice QSO with them.
And packet might be even easier, because with packet, it goes into a queue and they eventually get to it, I'd like to believe. Over to you for any tools on that, Rich.
Described, of course, it's a Leo, the ISS. Do you think that would be successful as opposed to a beam?
I'd like to believe that downlink on ISS is reasonably strong, and therefore the two vertical loops might be more than enough, and there's ways to check on that. There's ways to find out what is their transmit power. I know that I was using an extremely simple antenna, a quarter wave whip mag mount on the top of my car during the time that Owen Garriott was over northern Texas on space shuttle number 65. I think it was way back in 1985, 86. I heard him very well. So with direct line of sight, you don't need a beam and go through all the rigmarole of having to aim the damn thing. So those two vertical whips, those two vertical loops, from everything I know, they should have more than enough gain to do the receiving. And whether or not you've got enough power to transmit, to, you know, 5 watts into a beam versus 50 watts into a yucky antenna, I think the uplink is easy, Rich. Go ahead.
Yes. What about 50 watts going out?
You said, what about 2 blank going out? I missed a word.
50 watts. 50 watts.
I think that's more than enough. I bet you they're using 5 watts as a downlink. In the old days, when I listened to Owen Garriott over northern Texas, he was using a Motorola handy talkie. I don't think one of them ever ran beyond 5 or 7 watts, or Rich, go ahead.
Can I well look at Google? It's a good suggestion. So I guess I'll give you updates. You know, right now money is a premium, but I want to do this. This will give me another kick in amateur radio. Back to net, N2EO.
Dick, I think that's 5 watts out.
That's exactly what I thought. Because their history is using 5 watts, I don't think there's any great reason for them to change.
AC2GS?
You got it, Roy. It's a little higher. They're like 25. Now we're going back up to 25, but they're sending a Kenwood radio up there. They're going to get rid of the Ericsson HT. Heard, Roy.
You got it, Roy.
Let me stop.
Let me read a quick paragraph off of that page that kind of answers a whole bunch of questions. It says, a typical ground station for contacting the ISS station includes a 2-meter FM transceiver and a 25 to 100 watt output power, a circularly polarized cross Yagi antenna capable of being pointed in both azimuth and elevation is desirable, but successful contacts have been made with vertical and ground plane antennas.
KD2AMZ for comment.
First. Somebody first. Give us your full call and name. Go ahead, somebody first.
Maybe me, Kilo, Delta 2 Alpha, Mike Zulu, KD2AMZ, Mike.
KD2CXK. Do I have it?
And KD2EJ. CXK, AMZ, and EJ in that order. CXK, go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. Yeah, the ISS is using the Kenwood TMD710G, and they're using 25 watts from what I understand. KD2CXK, back to net.
What I was just going to tell you. Well, thank you, Craig and Eric. Also, AMZ, go right ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Rich, why don't just make life simple and practice with plain old-fashioned LEO satellites up there? There's plenty of them. I've done it many times with just a handheld and a simple antenna. The antenna he's referring to are their egg beaters because they're circular polarized. But rather than take away the learning experience from children, if you want to have space contact, and you can do this every single day, just use plain old-fashioned LEO satellites out there. Right? I think they just launched another one out there. So think about that, KD2AMZ.
Got another one for you. Go ahead, Eric.
If you go to ask.org, which is their page, they'll tell you that the previous radio was a 3-watt Ericsson handheld, and then they moved to the D710. And what they did was they built a key development. Yeah, I'm going to read from it. Key development is a multi-voltage power supply which interfaces multiple electric output connections type from the ISS to a multitude of power outputs capable of our current and future operations. It also allows our ham video system to have a dedicated power output, eliminating the output sharing which we now have, which shuts down the ham video at all times. You know that they're constantly transmitting images of the Earth, so, and I have picked them up on occasion.
Very good. Anybody else with any further info or questions on this subject, give me your call letters right now. K2LAW.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, they've had two radios up there, the Ericsson, and then the Russians had the, they had a D, I think it was the D-17, the Kenwood radio. So they were doing 25, and then we, since we've gotten up there since 2001, when Harry started with them, they were using the Ericsson. Eventually, that thing quit, and they sent up another Ericsson to replace that. But now there's another one that they just sent up a couple of months ago on the on one of the cargo ships. And as I didn't know it was installed, apparently it is now installed, according to what Eric said. But I thought they were going to wait another month or so before that was actually installed. But all the contacts so far, to give you an idea, they've been doing it with this 305 watts and successfully for decades now. So there you go. Back to you, then.
By the way, the clock is set properly, so it'll go off at midnight.
Thank you, Eric. Well done. The absolute worst-case Doppler you get for a low Earth orbit satellite at 2 meters is 4.3 kilohertz, plus or minus 4.3 kilohertz. That's when it's exactly on the horizon, aiming directly at you. When you're talking to it, much likely it's at a much higher altitude, slant range is a lot slower. So 4KC, I think the average FM receiver will continue to work at 4KC, obvious by the fact, 2KC is probably a typical offset. You and I have talked to lots of people who had a 5KC offset switch set wrong on 2 meters, and you still heard them. So don't worry about Doppler.
Repeater, timeout.
I agree with that. And by the way, most FM radios have an AFC in them, which tracks it for a little bit.
Another good piece of info. If you're talking to a guy in a satellite with single sideband, yeah, there you'd like the audio, you'd like the receiver to be set to the nearest 50 hertz. And with 2 or 3 kilohertz of offset due to Doppler, that's going to be a pain. You've got to continuously be tracking it. That's why I think the majority of QSOs through a satellite are FM, not sideband. Anyway, any further questions or comments? K2LAW.
K2LAW, John.
Go ahead, Eric.
Now, if you remember back at my house in Astoria, I used to do a lot of satellite work. There's actually quite a few winning transponders out there. And most of the guys that are serious about doing that, their tracking program also has Doppler compensation. Would actually, you set it up right, it tunes your radio. I did that with my Kansas City tracker. And that's an amazing job because, you know, when you're doing sideband, it's constantly moving. And having the computer do the tuning for you is really makes it a pleasure.
How far had you gone with that automation? With the antenna being moved in as an L and the Doppler being compensated all simultaneously, automatically?
That's correct.
Well done. I bet in those days it took a fair amount of work just to create an interface between the computer and the as an L motors of the antenna positioner. I bet you even that was a bit of work in those days. Is that true, Eric?
Well, in the days of the Kansas City tracker, which is an ISA card, it actually, the software that was written, there was Instatrack, and there was another tracking program, where the tracking programs knew where the IOs were in the ISA card, and that would, in turn, if you happened to hook it up to, like, my radio at that time was a 736, before I got the 748 or whatever the hell the number is. It's a pretty easy interface. If you happen to have the Acer AZL mount rotor, which was had a control box which had a DIN connector on the back of it, which in turn you would either connect to your Kansas City tracker, or actually you can still get from AMSAT, they have their latest program, which also does all of the above. You plug it right into the back of the rotor controller, and you plug it via the CAT port into your radio, and you're all set to go.
On many of the older repeaters, the rotator itself on the antenna had a potentiometer that gave you a voltage that went up and down as you went clockwise and counterclockwise. I think that would suggest that you needed an A to D somewhere in that antenna tracking function, didn't you, Eric?
Yes, you did. It actually created an analog voltage, which the controller would read and move the antenna. Actually, the elevation part of the rotor, plus and minus. We would be able to go from horizon to horizon, and the software would figure it out and know exactly what the antenna was doing. It would come to a point where it would be, 180 degrees, rather 90 degrees from horizon straight up, and the entire system would rotate so that way as it goes away towards the leaving horizon, the antenna would move around while it was still vertical, and as it headed towards the horizon, it would be pointed the right direction.
But heaven help you if the satellite went straight overhead, because if it went straight overhead, the azimuth has to swing 180 degrees in zero time.
Yeah, so what would happen is as the satellite got overhead, the azimuth would actually rotate, 180 degrees the opposite direction while it was still straight up. And as long as you had a circularly polarized antenna, or a cross-polarized antenna, you didn't really notice it. And if you were really good about it, because if you had a cross-polarized antenna, you could change from left hand to right hand, right while it was still vertical, and actually get a better signal on the way down.
Fantastic. Because in some of those cases, when it goes straight overhead, you're either looking at the front end of the satellite or the back end, therefore clockwise becomes counterclockwise. If the satellite had a turnstile-like antenna, depending on the bomb coordinate of the satellite, there could be essentially no polarization sense change as it went straight overhead. Eric, go ahead.
Why you made the switch.
So sometimes you needed it and sometimes you didn't need it. My guess is that the apogee intercepts, you didn't need it. At perigee intercepts, you did need it. Is that roughly true, Eric?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, sometimes the antenna on the bird would actually not be pointed quite at the earth. And you would actually have to override the computer and say, well, the left-hand polarization is the way it's supposed to be, but you switch over to right, you get a little bit of signal. It depends upon the bird itself. Some of them had actually circularly polarized antennas, and some of them just had cross-polarized antennas. Depends which satellite, who made it, and when it went up. The technology has increased as the time went on.
Yeah, the fancy word they use to try to explain to us is called bond coordinates. And phonetically, it sounded maybe it was spelled B-O-N. Anyhow, it really means where is the antenna bore site on the satellite aimed? Ideally, it's aimed at the center of the Earth. Well, you didn't have that very often. So depending on where it's aimed, you sometimes have to worry about polarization. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next person who asked the question. That was Steve, KC2MDP. Steve, how are those electrons in Baldwin treating you tonight? You got it, Steve, K2RIW.
Not bad, Dick, not bad at all. First of all, say good evening to you, and good evening to everyone on the net. Okay, my question tonight, Dick, is SWR. What I have is I have a 1.2 gig mobile antenna. It's on a 4-inch mag mount, and I'm having an SWR problem with this thing. I swept the antenna, basically. I swept it, at 1270 to 1300, and I'd say it's probably about 1.6 at 1270. By the time it gets to 1300, it's probably almost 5. What I did is replace the antenna with a dummy load, and basically I see the same pattern. Like 1270, it'll be, maybe it'll be, 1.8. It actually seemed to be better with the antenna on it. But anyway, with the dummy load, it was about 1.8, and probably by the time it got to 1,300, I'd say probably about 6. Is there a cutoff frequency for this? It's like a RG58 type coax. Can I shorten this cable? Basically, you know, shorten the cable once it enters the car and use LMR 400. What are your thoughts on this one, Dick? Back to you.
Wow. Wow. You said a number of ambiguities that we've got to clear up first before we can answer your direct sounding question. RG58 cable. I personally have used that well beyond 10 gigahertz, so that's not a function. RG58, no problem. And if your dummy load is good, and you measure the standing wave ratio through your RG58 into dummy load with well-connected connectors, you should measure 1-to-1. So what were you using to measuring VISWR? How in the world did a dummy load not give you a reasonable reading? If you put the dummy load directly on the instrumentation, did that read 1-to-1, but then when you went to the RG58, it read 6-to-1? Give us a few more words here, Steve. You got it, Steve. K2RIW.
Yeah, basically what I have is I have a Sightmaster. And, I did the open, the short, and the load. Basically the instrument 1-to-1. Now, the thing is I didn't use the dummy load, the precision dummy load. I had basically one... I bought a NMO to SO239, and I had a dummy load. It's probably not all that great, but I didn't think I'd see such a change in frequency. I have a change in SWR.
Okay, there's a further ambiguity here, Steve. When you're doing short load, open short load and whatever, that's calibrating the Sightmaster. That's just calibrating the Sightmaster, its cable, and its connectors, so that at the end of that cable, it reads accurately. In other words, it's as if all of the hardware inside the Sightmaster was mounted at the last 16th of an inch of that cable. That's what you're doing when you're doing that 12-point cal procedure. When you put a dummy load there, it better read 1-to-1. And then when you then connect instead your BNC cable into your dummy load, is that where you measured up to 6-to-1? Back to you on that one, Steve. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, Dick, basically, I did the calibration right at the unit itself. And then, of course, that's an N connector on there, so I used a N to SO239 and then connected the cable to that. And then, of course, on top of the mag mount, I had the NMO to SO239 and then the dummy load on top of that.
So, the dummy load on top of the mag mount gave you up to 6-to-1 standing wave ratio. And you have reason to believe that the dummy load mounted directly as close as you can, maybe with only one adapter, right at the end of the test cable on the Sightmaster, that measured 1-to-1. So, you seem to be telling me there's something funny going on with the mag mount itself, even before it gets to its radiator. That's what the info you're giving us seems to be saying, Steve. Wait for the beeps. You got it.
Okay, you got a point there. That I did not do. I did not connect the dummy load that was on top of the mag mount directly to the Sightmaster. Perhaps I should try that. Maybe there's something a little funky with that dummy load.
Yeah, the dummy load is part of the CAL procedure, the CAL hardware of the Sightmaster. That at the end of the cable obviously gave you a 1-to-1, probably with a 50 decibel reflection coefficient, S11, across the whole down frequency region, if you did the CAL procedure correctly. First of all, is that true? The CAL procedure, the CAL hardware, at the end of the Sightmaster test cable, did that give you a very low reflection coefficient, like 1.0001 over to you, Steve?
And QGZ.
Yes, it did, Dick. It was totally flat.
You've got it, Bill.
Hey, good evening, WB2QGZ. Just one thing with the NMO mounts. There are actually two different kinds of NMO mounts, and they're differentiated by the size of the center conductor pad and the mount, right? So there's one that's a kind of tiny little dot. I mean, maybe a 16th of an inch, and there's another one that's maybe a little bit bigger than a quarter inch. There is actually what they refer to as a high-frequency NMO, and that's good to, you know, allegedly 3 gigahertz or so, maybe even a little bit higher, I don't know. But it turns out that the NMOs that have the larger center pad tend to have a kind of capacitive issue and don't work too well above, I want to say, something like 600 megahertz. So I wonder if that's maybe complicating things.
And while you're with us, Bill, let me ask you this question. Does the NMO mount sometimes try to do some kind of frequency impedance matching? If you are running a whip that's a quarter wave, the base of a quarter wave whip is something in the vicinity of 35 ohms. So they might do an impedance match on that. Or if you were measuring a 5/8 wave, if you were radiating with a 5/8 wave, that's going to have some kind of a pretty wild impedance. So do any of those NMOs in the base contain any kind of impedance match dependent on what kind of a radiator you're using? Over to you, Bill.
No, they're pretty much, you know, a mechanical connection from the cable to the antenna. There's really nothing going on inside them. And if you get one of those NMO to N or whatever adapters that you can screw on the top, and you put a decent quality load on the top, you will get a good match. That's why I'm wondering if this is one of the lower frequency NMOs. But there's nothing fancy going on in that connector. The center pin solders directly to the bottom of that, or the center conductor solders directly to the bottom of the center pin, goes straight up through, typically, I guess it's Teflon or some kind of plastic, depending on who makes it and where you bought it, and the ground's the ground, so there's nothing going on in there.
That's good to know. Also, another good thing to know, Steve, is that any self-respecting adapter, I don't care if it's adapting from BNC to N to UHF to SMA to some of the really wild ones, the adapter itself is only, what, half inch, three-quarters of an inch long? You can't make something that's an impedance mismatch in that short a length. If it will pass an ohmmeter test, send a conductor feeds through, shield feeds through, send a conductor is not grounded to the shield, if it passes a triple ohmmeter test, at even 1296, you can't get more than a 1.2 viswar out of a connector where all the fingers are really making contact. So if your connector can pass an ohmmeter test, and if it can pass a visual test, don't blame the adapter. If your adapter can pass an ohmmeter test and it can pass a visual test, don't blame the adapter. It can't do it. Over to you, Steve. K2IW, wait for the beeps.
Yeah, Dick, I wasn't too concerned about the connectors. I figured, you know, all right, even if I did lose a little bit, but when I seen the wacky SWR, it sort of alarmed me. But you brought up a very good point. Yes, I will have to check that dummy load I was using on top of the mag mount. Maybe there's something up with that.
And before I go over to Eric, even if that dummy load just happens to be a 6-to-1 at the high frequency, and your antenna happens to be a 6-to-1 at the high frequency, that's a wild correlation. On top of that, that dummy load at the end of the cable from the site master, that's going to tell you a lot of information. KE2EJ, K2IW, Great Eric.
Yeah, while you guys were talking about this, I turned on the Rosen Schwartz vector network analyzer, and I took my Anritsu load, which you use to calibrate the site map, because I have one of those here too. And the return loss is really good, but when you finally hit about a gigahertz or so, it then starts to scallop. So around 1.1 gig, it runs from the scallops get deeper as you go higher in frequency, and it runs between like minus, the return loss on this is telling me between minus 20, and the deepest one is minus 26. So you may have a little bit of inaccuracy there, but I don't think it's enough to cause you to go to 6-to-1.
Hell no. 20 dB return loss, up to 26 dB return loss. That's extremely good. 20 is the worst portion of that. That means 1% of the power is reflecting. That's something like a 1.15 as well. So that would be a red herring, a false alarm, if you know what I mean. So do you have a chance? Is a site master in your neighborhood right now, where between now and the end of the TechNet, you could put your dummy load on the end of the cable of the site master and see what your dummy load is doing, Steve? KD2MDC. MDF. Here we go. You know who you are. I can't read my writing. You got it, Steve. KQRW.
KC2MDP. Yeah, Dick, I plan on doing that. I plan on checking this dummy load out ASAP.
Well, let us know what you find, because that's an interesting mystery. Okay, Joe's the next person on our list. W2RYY. K2RYW. Go ahead, Joe. Hello, Joe. K2, Romeo, Yankee, Yankee. K2RIW.
W2RYY, go ahead.
W2RYY, go ahead.
Okay. My question is actually quite simple. Maybe you have a simple answer for it. Maybe you don't have a simple answer for it. I don't know. I'll try anyway. How would you check the accuracy of your watt meter on a residential house type of installation? Any easy way to do that? Any thoughts or comments on that, just to see if it's running correctly?
Yeah, back in the old days, a very reliable dummy load would be a 100-watt light bulb. And if you want to test more watts than that, then put a number of 100-watt light bulbs in parallel. So a 100-watt light bulb fed from your 120-volt line should read, I'm gonna pick numbers out of the air, somewhere between 105 and 95 watts. The reason it's going to be a range is because the 100-watt light bulb is approximately 100 watts. The next level of accuracy would be a precision RMS voltmeter measuring voltage and current going into the bulb. And now you know exactly how many watts is dissipating. So that's one of the first things I would use. Your household watt meter. Are you talking about the thing that's got the spinning dial outside the house? Or are you talking about one of these devices called Kilowatt? There's a machine called Kilowatt in which you're supposed to plug all your appliances in the house one at a time and find out how much power they're really consuming. So what kind of a watt meter are we talking about here, Joe? Over to you, Joe, KQLAW.
Well, the old meters used to have the spinning dials. The newer ones are electronic. I'm talking about the outside ones. I haven't heard of the other thing you're talking about anyway. We'll talk about more about that in a few minutes.
Yeah, I'd like to believe that there is a relationship between the number of times that great big wheel, oh wait a minute, yours is digital. In the old days they had a wheel that was going to have you count the number of revolutions per minute. You can't do that with your digital. Your digital doesn't read watts, it reads watt hours. So if you knew for a fact that the element on your electric range consumes 3,000 watts, or your electric dryer consumes 3,000 watts, and you ran it for exactly 1 hour, then the number on the digital meter outside the house should go up by 3. It's not reading watts, it's reading watt hours. So you got that problem. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Right. I understand. That's what I'm talking about. Just to make sure that it's, you know, reading accurately and doing, you know, its job correctly, so you're not getting, you know, beat where it says you're using more electricity than you're actually using. You know, something like the speedometer in your car, which you know, you can easily check that by traveling, a certain distance in a certain amount of time, and you can figure out how many miles per hour. I know what wattage you'd have to know how much wattage you're pulling fairly accurately. Um, I just don't know if it's easy to make a load to do it that way, and if it's also got to be a combination of it's got to run off each leg, or it can run off one leg to ground if you were to put a load, you know. So I know he can do a number of things. You can read each leg to ground or cross it, which is typically where your stove is, because that's 220. Back to you.
Sure, sir. Steve, we had it recognized, and then somebody else. I'd like to believe that the meter, when it's reading one side to ground, 120 volts, 115, versus the whole 230 volts, that the meter keeps track of those. I'd like to believe that. And for you to build a dummy load, if you've got an electric range, electric dryer, or something like that in the house, you don't want to have to build a dummy load. That is a very high power load that can take it for a solid hour, particularly if you've got a pot of water on that element. Don't run an element on an electric range full blast with nothing on it where it's glowing red. You're using up its life when you do that. Make sure there's a pot of water there. And if it's a dryer, make sure the blower or the dryer is running. So a dryer or an electric range or your oven.
Repeater, timeout.
Those devices that I just mentioned, they're a beautiful dummy load. You don't have to build a dummy load. If you've got a house that's gas-fired and you've got no high-power electronic things like an electric dryer, electric range, electric oven, then the best thing you've got shy of that is a 100-watt or a 500-watt light bulb, and you run it for an hour. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, how do they keep track of a load on one side of the 230-volt line to ground as opposed to across the whole thing? We've got it, Eric. KE2EJ.
Well, actually, this is interesting because about a year ago, a friend of mine went from the mechanical meter to the electric meter, and his electric bill went up. He kept wondering why. Well, I'm spoiled rotten because I have a power analyzer. It deals with three-phase, single-phase, 220. You know, basically, you can think of it as two amp probes. And what we did was we created a load. Actually, it was an electric stove. Ran it for precisely an hour. We found out that the electronic meter was dead accurate, and the old mechanical meter was a little bit slow. So we've heard over the years that people complaining about when they get the electronic meter that they're being shafted, but in reality they're paying exactly what they're using, and the electronic meters are pretty accurate. I also have two electronic meters here, and when we put the power analyzer on it, they agree. So that's interesting. So it seems like the mechanical meters, either they're accurate. Actually, I've heard some stories where they actually run too fast, and then they get into the electronic meter, the electric bill drops a little bit. But usually it's the other way around. K2RW, KHJ.
Because I'm sometimes interested in great big numbers, Eric, at your broadcast station, and you can give the answer for either New York City or Plainview, when you turn everything on, your high-power transmitter, all of your high-power lighting because you're doing a pledge drive or whatever, if you turn everything in your facility on, what do you consume? I'm going to make a guess. 80 kilowatts? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Today you're not too far off. Normally around here, and by the way, the studio lights are LEDs, so we don't draw what we used to. But in the old days, actually, right now we draw about 95 kilowatts. And if I turn the standby transmitter on, it goes up a little more. But in the old days, with the big transmitter that used to put out a 1.3 megawatt CRT, and with the studio lighting, which drew about 2,000 amps, the usage was up around almost close to 200 kilowatts, so it's a big difference.
Wow. When you went to 200 kilowatts, if I measure the voltage before and after, the voltage that occurs at your fuse panel, so to speak, before and after you turn on 200 kilowatts, What kind of voltage drop are you getting, Eric? I know you've got some kind of a variac, what's the word for it now, servo mechanism that tries to keep the voltage constant going into the transmitter. But the raw voltage at your fuse panel, what would it do when you turned on and off 200 kilowatts? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Now, you got to consider my situation. I come in with 13 3-phase or 13.5, which is right outside my door here. That gets turned into 480. The 480 winds up, if you need 110 or 220, that goes into a Delta wire transformer to make that. But the reality is that the 480 output out of the step-down transformer from 13.5 has got four sets of double-aught cable leading from, for each phase, leading from the main transformer into the distribution network. And when everything's turned on, you barely see it drop by like a volt or a volt and a half. So, you know, that's a different kind of situation than somebody in their home was going to experience.
With that real heavy wiring you're describing, if something went really, really wrong, and you got a short circuit in that wiring in front of the fuse, boy, could you make smoke and flames. Out of curiosity, what does that fuse in your system look like, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, in the past, the fuse was actually on the pole. And the high voltage lines actually were buried in the ground. And I don't know if I showed you the last time I was here, you were here, but I have a couple of chunks of the high voltage cable that have disintegrated. And when the fuse blows now, the fuses were down by Washington Avenue, which is a good, maybe 2,000 feet away from here, or 1,800 feet or 1,500 feet. I don't know exactly how far it is. But when that fuse blew, you could hear it here. That's how loud it is. And of course, when the LiPo or the PSE&G guy came to replace the fuse, because I lost the phase, he put a new one in, it blew right up. That's when we knew that somewhere out there, one of the cables either disintegrated or shorted out. But don't forget, those high voltage cables have the, I forget the name of it now, but it's got those wires in the outside part of the jacket, so when it melts, it actually shorts the damn thing out. And interestingly enough, those cables were aluminum. Nice. Well, that's all been replaced. It actually goes a different path now. It runs in a nice conduit out into a vault that goes into a main distribution feed. But I think those fuses were something like 10,000 amps at 1,300 volts, so nasty.
Yeah, my next question is how physically big was that fuse? But when that cable shorted, which I think means you lost one phase, my guess is you weren't able to stay on the air with one missing phase. Is that true, Eric?
Well, some of the place stayed lit up. Don't forget I got UPSs on a lot of stuff, but not on the main transmitter. The transmitter has a 3-phase detector, and it actually will allow it to continue operating within, like, I think 3 degrees of one another, anything more than that. If it actually goes out of phase with one another, it will shut the transmitter down. If you lose one phase, it'll shut the transmitter down. If one phase drops by like 20%, it'll shut the transmitter down. So, yeah, when that happened, there was no transmitter. And, of course, at the time, I didn't have the 250,000-watt generator outside because it was, you know, one of those long terms, find the break, dig it up, fix it. We actually rented a generator to run for the time that happened. In the future now, we don't have to deal with that because I've got a quarter of a megawatt outside that comes on in about 10 seconds.
So therefore, you couldn't run your transmitter without phase missing, and it took you some length of time to get a generator shipped into the site. Does that say that you were roughly off the air for almost 24 hours, Eric?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was early in the morning. By, I think, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were back on the air. So, yeah, 6, 7 hours, something like that.
In that case, in the old days, you used to have to inform the Federal Communications Commission immediately when a broadcast station was not on the air. Do they still have that strict rule of if you're 10% low in power or if you're up the air, you have to tell the friendly candy company. Over to you, Eric.